Acts chapter 20. Paul is in Ephesus, and you remember last time we were looking at the riot in Ephesus. Demetrius, the silversmith, realizes that if what Paul's saying is right, and that God does not dwell in temples made by hands, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, that means that, well, no one needs a shrine, and no one will want a shrine, and I'll be out of business. And so he stirs up the crowd, and he gets a big crowd, and some of the crowd don't even know why they're there, but they start shouting out, "Great is Artemis, or Diana of the Ephesians." And the rabble chants this for 2 hours, until eventually the local city clerk gets in amongst them and calms them down and sends them away. But we find that the beginning of chapter 20, we're reminded that chapter and verse divisions are not inspired. Someone just thought, right, well, we've had enough of chapter 19, let's start chapter 20 there. Because chapter 20 begins after the uproar ceased, so it's really continuing on the narrative from the previous chapter. After the uproar ceased, Paul sent to the disciples and encouraged them. So Paul was planning to go anyway. He wasn't forced out by this agitation. He was planning his departure anyway. And so he said his farewells and set off for Macedonia. Macedonia, the northern part of Greece, or the southern part of FYR Macedonia. You think, FYR, former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, because the Greeks don't like the people in FYR Macedonia to call it Macedonia, because they say Macedonia is Greece, and they get very upset. So that's why the country that we would normally refer to as Macedonia is formally known as FYR Macedonia. But it's that part of the world. It's the top end. It's the top right side of Greece, the southern part of FYR Macedonia, where Paul is heading to. And he's going back through these places, and he is encouraging them in the faith. We learn from what he says in Romans that his plan is to collect funds for encouraging the church in Jerusalem. They were suffering famine, they were short of food and various other resources, and so Paul was taking up a collection. Not in the way we would. We'd say, let's have a collection for some part of the world, some church somewhere. And we do it, and we go to the bank, pay it in, and the funds would be transferred electronically. You couldn't do that in those days. You actually physically had to take the money from point A to point B. It took a lot longer to collect. It took a lot longer to deliver. We read in Romans chapter 15 what Paul's plans were. This is starting halfway through the verse in Romans 15:19. From Jerusalem and all the way round to Illyricum. Illyricum is pretty much modern Croatia. I have fulfilled the ministry of the gospel of Christ, and thus I make it my ambition to preach the gospel not where Christ has already been named, lest I build on someone else's foundation, but as it is written, those who have never been told of him will see, and those who have never heard will understand. This is the reason, remember, he's writing to the church in Rome. This is the reason I have so often been hindered from coming to you. I've been preaching elsewhere. But now, since I no longer have any room for work in these regions, because he's gone everywhere and preached everywhere, and since I have longed for many years to come to you, I hope to see you in passing as I go to Spain and be helped on my journey there by you once I have enjoyed your company for a while. At present, however, I am going to Jerusalem, bringing aid to the saints. For Macedonia and Achaia, it's all Greece. Achaia is the southern part of Greece, Macedonia is the northern part, have been pleased to make some contribution for the poor among the saints at Jerusalem. They were pleased to do it, and indeed they owe it to them, for if the Gentiles have come to share in their spiritual blessings, they ought also to be of service to them in material blessings. When therefore I have completed this and delivered to them what has been collected, I will leave for Spain by way of you. And I know that when I come to you, I will come in the fullness of the blessing of Christ. So this was Paul's plan, but first he goes from Ephesus, he goes north up into Greece, into Macedonia, and then round down Greece, and he ends up in Corinth. How do we know he ends up in Corinth? Since it doesn't explicitly mention Corinth there. He'd gone through those regions and had given them much encouragement, revisiting the churches previously established, as was Paul's pattern. He came to Greece, where he spent 3 months. This would be the winter of 56 to 57 AD. And it is when he was there in Corinth that he wrote Romans. Now, this is a very cursory account. Paul went here, there, and then he went back again. Luke, remember, wasn't with him. There's no we in this passage here. Luke was not with him. So Luke is just saying, oh, and Paul went here, there, and so he's not giving us great details, but we do know that Paul was writing Romans from Corinth, and it was on this visit to Corinth that he wrote Romans. Romans tells us he was in Corinth, and we know that it was at this period from other things, and so therefore this visit to Greece meant he must have gone to Corinth, because otherwise he couldn't have written Romans from Corinth. So it was Corinth that he visited and spent 3 months there. And although Luke skates over his time there, it was while he was there that Paul wrote probably what is the most important letter of all the letters that he wrote, in which he spells out with great clarity the essence of the gospel and its implications for us. But as he sets off, he's seeking to head off to Jerusalem, and his first thought doubtless was that he might get to Jerusalem in time for Passover. But as he's leaving, in verse 3, after 3 months, a plot was made against him by the Jews as he was about to set sail for Syria. Syria, remember, is where Antioch is. Antioch is where he set off from to begin with. So he was planning to go back to Antioch, where he had started his missionary journey, visit the church there, and then go down to Jerusalem. Sorry, there he was going to go up to Jerusalem. But there was a plot. Paul heard of this plot. The Jews hated him, if you remember, back in chapter 18. There was a riot. Interesting, it seems everywhere Paul went, there was a riot. But there was a riot in Corinth. And verse 12 of Acts 18, when Gallio was proconsul of Achaia, the Jews made a united attack on Paul and brought him before the tribunal, saying, this man is persuading people to worship God contrary to the law. And Gallio says, I'm not interested, go away. He drove them out of the tribunal. Verse 17, and they all seized Sosthenes, the ruler of the synagogue, and beat him up in front of the tribunal. But Gallio paid no attention to any of this. So the Jews, we know from there, the Jews in Corinth did not like Paul because of what he was saying. And so back in Corinth for 3 months, about to leave, and they think, ah, he's going on one of the pilgrimage boats, because a lot of Jews would travel to Jerusalem for the festivals. And they thought, ah, he's going on one of these boats, we can have some of our men on the boat and we can throw him over the side, or whatever. We don't know the details of the plot. They thought, we can get rid of him. And so Paul plans, therefore, instead of going by sea, he would foil the plot by going a different way. And so his life was preserved, but it meant it took him a lot longer because he was going over land. And so the thought of getting there in time for Passover, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, it now meant that it was going to take a lot longer. And so his aim then was to be there in time for Pentecost, which is what we read at the end of verse 16. That was now his plan. So he heads off back north, up through the various places, and we read that there are these various people with him in verse 4. And doubtless these were people who were representatives of some of the churches that were giving money. And they wanted to go as well. They didn't want to just give Paul the money and say, fine, bye, Paul. I don't think it's because they didn't trust him. I think it's because they wanted to express their unity and their solidarity with the church in Jerusalem and say, look, my church has given this because we love you in the Lord Jesus Christ. And so Paul had a number of travelling companions, and off they went up through Greece, round the top, and they came to Philippi. Except, of course, that they went ahead of him. They were waiting for us at Troas. Paul was a bit slower than they were. But they headed off to Troas. But you notice there's a very significant word appears in verse 6. I wonder if any of the children are awake enough to know what that very significant word in verse 6 is. Jonathan. Correct. We. But we sailed. Luke has reappeared. We sailed away from Philippi. Philippi was where Luke came from. So Paul returned to Philippi, met Luke again, doubtless looked him up, and Luke joined the party, and they sailed away from Philippi after the days of unleavened bread. The days following the Passover. And in 5 days we came to them at Troas, where we stayed for 7 days. So Paul stayed at Troas a week. Now whether this was because Paul was beginning to get on and his arms and legs were beginning to ache, he was beginning to feel his age, or just because he wanted to meet with the church in Troas, we don't know. But what we do know is that they met with the church in Troas on the first day of the week. On the first day of the week when we were gathered together to break bread. Now it is probably significant that it says the first day of the week. Because since he stayed there for 7 days, it was the first day of the week on which he met with the church. It might be that it was just because it was the day before he left. Because that's what it says in verse 7, intending to depart the next day. So you can't prove absolutely from this that it was the common practice of all churches to meet on the first day of the week. But they did meet on the first day of the week. And the reason why we don't keep the Sabbath and we meet on the first day of the week is because it appears that's what they did in the New Testament. But there are hardly any references at all. Paul says at the end of 1 Corinthians 16 that the church there is to lay aside money on the first day of the week. Possibly when they met together, but not necessarily. Here we have the first day of the week mentioned. The other references to the first day of the week are found in the Gospels, where it says that Jesus rose from the dead on the first day of the week. But there are other questions that we need to mention in passing. The first day of the week. Now, when was this? Was this a Saturday or was this a Sunday? And some people would immediately say, but it's the first day of the week. We know that's Sunday. On the Jewish calendar, the first day of the week is a Sunday. On the Roman calendar, the first day of the week is a Saturday. Is Luke using Roman, or is Luke using Jewish calculations? And I think that we can say that he was using Jewish methods of determining the days of the week. This was the day after the Sabbath. However, on the first day of the week we were gathered together. Paul prolonged his speech till midnight. They did not meet at 11 o'clock and Paul preached all through the day until midnight. Verse 8, there were many lamps in the upper room. This was the evening. The Jews reckoned the day to begin at sunset. So therefore the Sabbath begins on a Friday evening when the sun goes down, and it finishes on Saturday evening when the sun goes down. The Romans, however, considered that the day began at dawn. And so there are two possibilities here. One is that this was Saturday evening, and so therefore by Jewish reckoning it was Saturday evening, therefore it was the first day of the week. That's Jewish reckoning. Or the day began at dawn, first day of the week, therefore the evening of the Sunday. I've probably got you completely confused, but it would appear that since elsewhere, for example in Acts chapter 2, Luke uses Roman time methods when he says, when Peter says, how can we be drunk when it is only, where are we? Let's find the verse so I can point you to it. Acts 2 verse 15. These men are not drunk as you suppose, since it is only the third hour of the day. It's only 9 o'clock in the morning. 3 hours since dawn. So that's a Roman method of calculating the time through the day. So it would appear in terms of time, Luke was using the Roman method, and so that would make this Sunday evening. And therefore, by Jewish reckoning, this was Monday morning. Sorry, not Monday morning. This was Monday evening, because by Jewish reckoning, Monday began at sunset on Sunday. Confused? Don't worry about it. Paul met with the church, and he intended, in order to break bread. Now, this may have been merely a fellowship meal together. It may have been a fellowship meal at which they remember the Lord's death. It may have been merely they met together to remember the Lord's death in the Lord's Supper. I think it was the second one. I think they had a fellowship meal and they remembered the Lord's death in the breaking of bread. But notice what was the emphasis of this gathering together. What was the important thing for Paul in meeting with them? Paul sang, spoke in tongues, danced, waved his arms in the air. Doesn't say that, does it? Paul talked with them. Paul conversed with them, intending to depart the next day. And as he prolonged his speech until midnight. Now, there are people who complain about the length of sermons. I remember preaching at one place many years ago in South London, and I was warned about a certain lady who had been there for many years, and they said, well, you will notice the clock on the wall, however, you don't need to look at the clock, because at this time, I think it was 7:30, on the dot at 7:30, this little old lady sitting at the back will close her Bible. That's her way of telling you, your time is up. Come in, number 23. Some people complain when people preach for longer than 5 or 10 minutes. My aunt used to say to me, when she would complain about the minister of the church we then attended preaching for 35 or 40 minutes, goes on far too long. My vicar always used to say, if you can't say it in 10 minutes, it's not worth saying. To which I responded, if you can say it in 10 minutes, you've got nothing worth saying. You are perhaps familiar with a device called an hourglass. One of the purposes of an hourglass, particularly in the 17th century, was so that the congregation could see that they were getting their money's worth. And the sermon would begin and they would turn over the hourglass. And woe betide any minister who finished preaching before the last grain of sand had fallen through. Some of these hourglasses have survived to the present day and you can time them and they seem to work out to about 45 minutes. So people were in fact being shortchanged. People have different views on how long a sermon should be. On two occasions, I have had people come up to me after a sermon and complained about the length. Your sermon, they said, was not long enough. You should have gone on for at least another half an hour. I remember sitting in a meeting in Glasgow where my friend was preaching and I was taking notes so I could probably work out what he was preaching on if I dug through all the notes I've taken over the years. And I thought, this is wonderful. And he said, well, we really must finish now. Why? Please carry on. Then I looked at my watch. Well, I suppose after an hour and a half, he might be feeling a bit exhausted. Meanwhile, another couple of friends, a married couple, were complaining bitterly to him afterwards. Why did you go on so long? And I was saying, why did you stop so soon? Different people have different capacities. Some people are thinking of themselves as the clock ticks by. The meat's in the oven. If I don't get back quick, then it's going to be burnt to a crisp. It's like when the social worker came round to visit my father. Just after one of his neighbours had called in, and I'd got some sausages on. And we were sitting talking away, and she got round to asking about, and how are you feeding yourself? And I said, ah, yes, feeding. Excuse me a moment. I had moved the smoke alarm. They were still edible. But I had to have all the doors and windows open to get rid of the smoke. So there are some people who have these things on their minds as they're listening. Some people are thinking, oh, I wish he'd hurry up. I've got to go to the loo. Some people think, I've got to be somewhere. I've got to catch a train. A few weeks' time, I have to catch a train at about 1:30 on a Sunday in order to get down to London for a committee meeting on the Monday. So you might find the sermon's quite short that morning. Or you might find that I just rush at the end. Paul's concern was not, oh, well, here's my digital watch, so therefore you've now had a sermon lasting, so therefore it's time I stopped. Paul thought, I might never see these people ever again. Have I told these people everything they need to know? There's lots of errors floating around. Have I shown them why these errors are wrong? I am concerned for the spiritual well-being of these people. These people need information about the gospel, about its application. These people need to understand God's truth. You read through Paul's letters and repeatedly he is talking about how important teaching is. Teach, teach, teach. Ignore those who teach that which is false. Hold fast to that which is true. But it's teaching, teaching, teaching that Paul is constantly emphasizing. That is what is important. If you don't know the truth, you will not practice the truth. People say, oh, but I'm not interested in theology. I just believe in Jesus. Really? I'm now quoting from a theologian. Someone said this to him once. I'm not interested in all that theology stuff. I just believe in Jesus. Really, he said. What do you mean by believe? That's a theological question. What do you mean by Jesus? That's a theological question. What do you mean by I? That's a theological question. So people might say, oh, I just believe in Jesus. Yeah, but who is he? What has he done? How can we appropriate the benefits of what he's done for ourselves? That's all theology. That's what Paul was talking about. That's why Paul, as we read, prolonged his speech until midnight. He got so much he wanted to tell them, and so little time. So he continued until midnight, giving them God's truth. And I think you'll find that for most gospel preachers, if you think God is going on a bit. It's because they have a passion to communicate God's truth to you in order that you might know God's truth, in order that you might know God's forgiveness in your hearts, that you might experience forgiveness, know God, and then live for God and bring glory to God, and at the end, be with God in glory forever. That's why Paul prolonged his speech until midnight. Then we have verse 8. There were many lamps in the upper room where they were gathered. Ah, people say, see? So it's right and proper we should have candles burning. No. We have lights. The whole purpose of the lamps was to provide light. It was evening, going on towards midnight. If Paul had not had the lamps in the room, well, have you ever been in a darkened room at midnight and someone's speaking and you're thinking, where are they? And your ears and your eyes start to play tricks on you. And you're thinking more about the visual illusions, the tricks that your eyes are playing upon you, rather than what's being said. It is useful to actually see who is speaking to you. And so they had the lamps there in order to be seen. There's no religious significance in the lamps. The significance of the lamps is in what follows. Unlike these lamps, the lamps then, being naked flames, burned up the oxygen, and there was the smell of burning lamps in the room. Now, this was an upper room. It was the third story. And so, burning up the oxygen and filling the room with fumes, it would begin to get a bit soporific. Soporific makes you tired. Now, there are some preachers who speak in a monotone and they never vary their tone of voice at all. And the consequence is that it very quickly sends you off into a very deep sleep. And it's not long before the preacher realizes he needs to do something because all he can hear is... It happens with us. I remember, again, many years ago, there was one elderly gentleman, now dead. He was in his 70s, and he would sit there. He'd be at, not the back row, but he was at the back. There was no one else behind him. And I would notice at some point during the sermon, his head would be back, his jaw would have dropped, and he was fast asleep. No, I didn't stop and say, oh, excuse me, Mr. So-and-so, how dare you fall asleep while I am preaching? I don't think I'm that important. Now, I recognise that people are different. Some people do fall asleep. It's not immoral. Perhaps they had a very bad night's sleep. Perhaps they got woken up early in the morning by someone using a strimmer. Or banging in fence posts, which we've experienced on Sunday mornings for the last few weeks. Sometimes it's a chainsaw. Who knows why someone is dropping... Oh. We don't know. What I did was I would find some excuse for raising my voice. I didn't wake up again. No one else would know. He wasn't embarrassed. Now you're going to think, every time I raise my voice, it's because someone's dropped off and I'm trying to wake them up. So I'm going to be watching you the next time I raise my voice to see if you're looking round to see which person is going, Brett Humber. There was a young man named Eutychus who was sitting at the window. And Eutychus, because of the atmosphere and because Paul was going on so long, he'd had a long, hard day. They'd all been at work. This was not a day off for them. Sunday was a working day for everybody. So they'd worked hard. And there's Eutychus, a young man. I have heard it suggested a young man means someone between the ages of 7 and 14. Others, it's someone below the age of 25. We don't know how old he was, but he was young and fit and healthy in the prime of life. Because after 25, you start going downhill. There he was, sitting in the window, and he began to drop off. And, of course, they didn't have glass in the windows. And if the window opening was here, and he's sitting on the windowsill... Whee! From the third floor. That's quite a drop. So, any of you who have a tendency to fall asleep during the sermon, I suggest you take great care in choosing where you sit, because you don't want to embarrass yourself. You don't want to hurt yourself. Some people might find that the carpeting on the pews, if it's slippery, and so you might slip forward and you bash your head on the back of the pew. Other people might be sitting on the end and you just fall over into the aisle. And there's all sorts of ways in which you can injure yourself by falling asleep. So if you are, this is not making any moral judgments, but if you're inclined to drop off, think of the position in which you're sitting. We don't want you to injure yourself. We don't want you to embarrass yourself. That's not what it's about. We're not talking about how some people are more wonderful than others because they can complete a marathon, while the rest of us have trouble even walking 100 yards. My excuse is my shoulder. It's very painful after 100 yards. It's not a moral issue. It's a practical issue. If we really love one another, these silly things will concern us, because we want to appreciate people work hard. We want to appreciate people sometimes do have difficulty in concentrating and do fall asleep. It's not a crime, but there is a danger. And Eutychus discovered that danger by falling out of the window. And remember, Luke was here. Luke was writing this. Luke doubtless went down and looked at him and said, "He's dead." He was taken up dead. Paul went down, bent over him, and taking him in his arms, said, "Don't be alarmed, for his life is in him." And we previously read in, for example, 1 Kings 17 about Elijah, 2 Kings 4 about Elisha, Acts chapter 9 about Peter and Dorcas, people who were dead, were brought back to life. And it would appear that Eutychus was dead. But Paul, as an apostle, was able to restore life to him. "Don't be alarmed, his life is in him." And when Paul had gone up and had broken bread and eaten, right, so midnight, Eutychus falls out of the window. Oh dear. Oh well, we'll have to rush him off to casualty. We'll have to do this, that and the other. We'll have to inform the family. And oh dear, what are we going to say to the police? And this is going to take hours and probably days to sort out. They take him up alive. And they carry on with the meeting. "Don't be alarmed, his life is in him." And when Paul had gone up and had broken bread and eaten, they carried on with what they were doing. He conversed with them a long while. So Paul had been speaking to midnight, till midnight, and had only been interrupted by Eutychus falling out of the window. And then he carried on. Now, I don't think what was going on here was that Paul was preaching. The word used is conversing. In fact, that's the origin of the word sermon from the Greek and the Latin. It has to do with conversing. It would be a two-way affair. So Paul would give them some truth, and then someone would say, "Excuse me, Paul, I didn't quite understand that last bit. What did you mean by this? Or you quoted this passage from the Old Testament. I don't quite understand how that proves what you're saying." And so then Paul would respond to them and explain to them why that was the case. Now, some preachers think that preaching involves a monologue that the preacher merely preaches, and woe betide anyone who dares to question what is said. Whereas you know that here, come a Sunday evening, almost the first thing I say is, has anybody got any questions or comments from this morning? Is there anything that anybody didn't understand? I'm concerned with communication. And if I've said something, I've used words that you don't understand. If I was to talk, for example, about tintinnabulation, and you would scratch your head and say, what on earth does that mean? Don't worry. If you are worried, go and look it up. It just happens to be a nice sounding long word. It's communication that's important. And so therefore I'm quite happy for people to ask questions. And even to say, I'm not sure I agreed with what you said there. And then we can discuss it. It's always possible I'm wrong. It's always possible you're wrong. It's always possible we're both wrong. And sometimes we're both right. But that's the whole point. Questions should be asked. There should be discussion. And I think that's what was going on here. And because Paul was departing and probably never going to see them again, we read that he continued conversing with them a long while until daybreak. So that's probably until 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning when he departed. And they took the youth away alive and were not a little comforted. And so Paul is doing this while Eutychus is still recovering. They say, well, he's alive, but he's quite possibly unconscious. But we'll just leave him there. And then as Paul departs, so they took away the youth alive. He's recovered and appears to be none the worse for it. And then just very quickly, these last few verses, 13 to 16, Paul then sets off on his journey, heading off for Jerusalem. He's wanting to be there by Pentecost. Paul, still being a Jew, was observing Jewish festivals. We'll see more of this later on in Acts. But we find that there is this one point where he sends them on the boat to Assos while he walks. We don't know why he walked. That was about 15 miles, I think. Perhaps he just wanted to be alone. He wanted to pray and to contemplate and commune with God without all these people around him. But eventually they meet up again at Assos and they take him on board and off they go, and they're going round the coast of what is modern Turkey, in and out of all the little islands, and eventually they arrive at Miletus. Miletus is a port not that far from Ephesus, but Paul decides not to go to Ephesus. He knows if he goes back to Ephesus, he'll get stuck there for a long time. He wants to get to Jerusalem by Pentecost. He can't afford the time, and so instead he stops at Miletus and calls upon the elders of the church at Ephesus to come to him so they can have a short meeting and then he can continue on his journey, which is what we will be looking at next week. But just to consider briefly things that come out of this, Paul, we see, was single-minded in his plans. I'm going to Jerusalem. Now, his plans had to change because of plots, but Paul was single-minded in carrying out his plan. This is what he was going to do. Change his plan when necessary. Do we have a plan and a purpose for what we are doing with our lives? And are we seeking to follow that plan and amending it as necessary as time goes by? We do seek to follow the apostolic practice of meeting on the first day of the week. We are not Jews. We are Gentile believers in the Lord Jesus Christ. And so we follow the apostolic practice of not meeting on the Sabbath, but meeting instead on the Sunday, the first day of the week, as they did in Troas, as appears from this to have been apostolic practice, and in memory of the resurrection of the Lord Jesus Christ. As I said, Sunday was a working day, and that's why they had to meet in the evening. Do we desire to learn God's truth as much as they did? Are we prepared to sit and listen to the gospel being expounded as much as they did, or do we complain about the length? Some people do just shut off after a certain period of time. Don't worry, there are others who love things to go on longer than that. Do you primarily desire to learn God's truth? Do be careful where you sit in case you fall asleep. And do remember, if you fall asleep, recordings are always available, such as they were not in the first century. Eutychus missed some of what Paul said. You don't need to miss anything that is said. And notice, again, no concern about singing, dancing, and miracles. The important thing is the impartation of truth concerning God, concerning the Lord Jesus Christ, concerning salvation, concerning how to live, concerning heavenly glory. And are our hearts and minds filled with truth about what is to come, what Christ has done, what glorious hope is laid up for those who believe in the heavenly places? Does it fill us with joy, looking forward to it? And does it help us, as we contemplate these things, to live godly lives in this world? So with that, we're going to end, and we will consider, God willing, next week, Paul's parting words to the Ephesian elders.